Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary Show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit in creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns.
Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary Show. And today we have a very special treat. We have the author of Saving the Beast. A recovering reporter reflects on America's broken media and how to fix it. So Ted Check, he is a husband, a father, a journalist, an author, a public information officer. And he's got it's going to be a great conversation. So
Hillary, thank you very much. Ted. Great to be here.
Yeah, I didn't want to spill too much of it, but I just read his book, and you know what? If you have any interest in journalism and what's happening in our country, I don't know about the world, but got to read this book, Saving the Beast. It really will open your eyes and make you concerned, right?
But
there are solutions at the end, so that's good. All right.
Yes, yes.
So Ted had a 25-year career in journalism. And what had you write your book?
Well, I left journalism about 3.5 years ago because there were things that were going on in the industry that really I found unsettling. Really kind of had me disturbed and disappointed at the same time. And so I took off for the dark side, as we say in journalism, the other side of the communications coin, which would be public relations. And actually, it's a common destination for those in journalism. They jump from that to public relations. It's not uncommon for that to happen. I am enjoying it. Yeah, go ahead.
Why do you call it the dark side?
The dark side. Well, because in journalism, you owe your allegiance to the truth, and you owe your allegiance to your readers or your viewers. But if you're in public relations, you owe your allegiance to your employer, who pays you. And so, generally speaking, the messages that you are producing and disseminating are not going to reflect negatively upon your employer.
Your boss or your clients?
Well, it depends. If you're in the private sector, you might have a portfolio of clients. But if you're in the public sector, say you work for a law enforcement agency, or you work for a county government or a state government or the federal government, you know, then they would be your employers. So you have a public. Okay, we'll take
and
something.
Which is yours?
Well, I work for a county government.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yes. Okay. We'll take a current something that's going on right now. You know, the wildfires in California. So you would have a public information officer who would hopefully be setting up those news conferences that you see, writing the copy that the people are what they're saying, or at least having a conversation with them. Okay, I would say to them, you know, we're not going to admit that we've totally lost control of our emergency warning system, which they did. They admitted that. There'd be a way to talk about that honestly, but yet without saying, look, we have no control over this thing and we don't know what to do. You know, that's not what you want to say as a public information officer. Or as someone, as a PIO who's in the background, giving advice to whoever is front facing. So yeah, that's just an example of kind of what a PIO would do. They'd work on a lot of different things like social media and cultivating you know, relationships with the media. And so you're on a different, you're on the other side of things. So as a reporter, I'd be calling PIOs saying, hey, I need information about this, that, and the other thing. Now I'm the guy, I'm the PIO, and I'm giving information to the reporter. So it's a little bit different for me, but it's been a huge learning curve, you know, but it's been great.
So what would you say, like you're in Pennsylvania, right? But you're reporting about the fires in LA?
Oh, me? No, I was just using that as an example. What I would do if I was a public information officer in California. I am in Pennsylvania. I have nothing to do with what's going on there. I was just kind of providing some commentary on what's going on over there. But back to the book. There were a lot of things that I saw going on in the industry that had me very concerned. One of which was the media had eschewed critical thinking. They had resorted to telling the American public what and how to think, rather than as a journalist, your job is to lay everything out there for people to say, like, hey, this is everything we know at this point in time. Lay it all out there for them. And let them decide, you know, and maybe that's an opportunity for the reader to conduct their own research, to look at other sources, and then kind of develop, you know, using critical thinking, develop their own point of view. It's not the media's job to tell people what to think.
Right. And when do you think that changed and why? Like, when did they start telling us how to think and giving us their opinions instead of the facts?
Right. I traced it back to several decades ago. It started several decades ago because it wasn't certainly what I was taught in journalism school. So I went to school for law enforcement, and that's how I became a crime writer. So I was a crime writer, crime reporter for 25 years, crime and emergency news. But having that degree in law enforcement helped me. I parlayed that into a career in journalism. So initially I graduated in 1992, and then I had a couple of years off, and then I went back to school for journalism. So in the mid 90s, let's say.
And were you ever were you ever a law enforcement? Did you ever do that?
Law enforcement adjacent. I was employed by a police department over a summer. But I was handing out parking tickets. I wasn't a police officer. I was a meter maid. Well, we didn't do meters. It was sticker parking. But anyway, and then I did things like I was a park ranger for a couple of seasons. I was a security officer at a hospital. So things like that. So this is kind of quasi, you know, law enforcement adjacent, but not true law enforcement.
And what made you go to journalism school instead of pursuing that?
Well, one thing was I didn't think that I would when I actually sat down and kind of contemplated things, I wasn't sure that I had the right that I was emotionally ready for it, because it's a big decision to be the great power comes great responsibility, as we know from the Spider-Man movies. And but it's true in law enforcement, right? I mean, you're a sworn officer. Sworn to uphold the law, to serve and to protect, and it's something that should be taken seriously. And I wasn't sure when I actually sat down and thought about it that I was ready at that point at 22 years old. Now some people are, and that's fine, but I wasn't. So if I could have the mind I have now in a 22 year old's body, wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be awesome? I think I'd be very effective as a police officer. But anyway,
I know I'm taking you off, but I get a question. Okay. What had you not be emotionally ready?
I was worried I couldn't handle the strain of dealing with criminals day in and day out. And, that it might affect me, that it might affect, my mind, you know, and also I was worried about, what if I, anger the wrong person and they try to come after me or my family, things like that. So, it had me really concerned. And I guess I never, you know, when you're in college, you're kind of in a bubble. Yeah. You're kind of insulated from the rest of the world. And you kind of don't think about these things. I was thinking about Miami Vice and how cool it would be to be a Cub. You know, I was kind of caught up in the glamour of it all. And then reality struck. So then I went back to school.
Very mature of you. There's probably more people that should do that, but don't, right?
You know, it's something to consider. But yeah. I think we have a lot of, I work with a lot of law enforcement officers now, and we have a lot of great men and women who are, who answer the call, and I respect them deeply, you know.
Anyway, okay.
So I took one course in journalism at the University of Rhode Island, and I was hooked. I said, let me just take one, because I knew I wanted to do something in writing, because the other side of my brain doesn't work right as far as like science and math. I'm just not gifted in that way. Always enjoyed writing, though.
Wow.
So you have to know your strengths. Yeah. So I always enjoyed writing, I was like, well, if I was going to do something with writing, well, I could write books, which eventually I did. That's why we're here. But I was like, well, but I could teach, but I don't want to teach young people. I want to teach, you know, like college. And, you know, generally you have to be a PhD, and that's going to take a long time. And here I was, you know, 23, 24 at that point. And I'm like, I don't have a lot of time. So let's get going on this. Let's do journalism. And also, beyond all that, my mother was a reporter. Before her, my grandmother, her mother was a reporter as well.
Oh, cool.
Both of them in the Midwest, in Michigan and Ohio. So you might say that it was in the blood. I remember my mother, you know, attending meetings late at night, and remember her taking me into her office, you know, and showing me her typewriter, because back then, you know, that was what they used, you know, long before Apple came along and all that, but Apple and IBM. You could say it was in the blood. So I took one course, and I'm like, okay, we're off and running. And I was working full time as a security officer at a hotel, not a hotel, a hospital in Providence, Rhode Island, and then going to school at night.
Wow.
And then got my degree in that. And
at URI, did you finish there? Oh,
yes.
Cool. Wow. Yeah. So how did you end up in Pennsylvania?
Well, I started looking for a job in New England, but there really wasn't anything that nobody wanted me. I actually even had 5 months of solid full-time reporting before I graduated, because I took a leave of absence during that time. There was a startup newspaper. It's crazy, but somebody actually started up a newspaper. You don't hear about that. You just hear about newspapers that are 100, 150, 200 years old. But this guy came into some money. He lived in Northern Rhode Island, and he hated his hometown paper, and he wanted to put it out of business, so he started up his own paper. But as it turned out, he himself went out of business 5 months later. But it was fantastic for me. A guy who hadn't even finished his degree. I didn't even have my BA in journalism yet. And he hired me because of my past, you know, degree in law enforcement. And then I sent him some clips that were never even published. They were just clips that I had written for class. And on that, he took a chance and hired me. And it was great, you know, and because you always, or at least I have in my career, in my life, encountered this whole, well, how am I going to get experience if nobody takes the chance to give me experience? Because you can't just fabricate it out of nothing. Somebody has to take a chance on you, see something in you, see the potential in you, and take a chance on you. And that's what this guy did. And so I was his crime reporter. And the paper went out of business, but it was great experience. So anyway, I had that. You know, most kids, I don't think, when they're a senior in college, they're about to graduate, they don't have full-time experience. They might have had some internships, but I'm talking about full-time salaried experience. And so I had that, but yet the Providence Journal didn't want me. The Newport Daily News didn't want me. So I just started, which is fine. And so it's because it all worked out in the end. So I broadened my search, and a job in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, was offered to me. It was a Gannett paper. I think it still is a Gannett paper in little old Chambersburg, which is kind of south central Pennsylvania. And so I was there a little under 2 years, and then moved to York, which is, well, compared to Chambersburg, it's a burgeoning metropolis. The county's not bad. York County has close to 500,000 people. And it's got a little bit of everything. We've got a small city, York City, and then we've got lots of sprawling suburbia, but we have a lot of farmland as well. And we've got two major, an interstate running through us, and we're about 45 minutes from Baltimore. So it does all right. We do all right.
Wow.
So certainly enough to keep a crime reporter busy.
Yeah.
For sure.
So you loved that. Did you love it?
Reporting?
Yeah.
For a long time I did, until we'll get back to you. Yeah. When I realized what was going on in the industry. And so things changed, and it was somewhere in the mid 90s, because that's when I went to journalism school. So it had to have changed at some point after that, where there was a philosophy that started, it seems like, from all I can tell, started creeping in, which allowed the professors started teaching their students that they had the moral latitude to choose a side in whatever issue it was that they were writing about, and then advocate for that side advocate for that side in their reporting. So it goes by many names, but it could be advocacy journalism or activism journalism, solidarity journalism. It's all essentially the same animal. And that seriously has, and it's in the book, it's crept into the to colleges and universities, so that's what really alarmed me.
So you're taught the truth, lay out the facts, people, come up with their own version or their own,
however many sides there are to an issue, report everything you possibly can, everything that you know about it,
it's clean, it's true. Okay. All where the heck would these professors come from that all of a sudden are changing the game? Like, how do you think that arose? That's balls. It's balls, right?
It is quite.
Change the game of journalism. Like, who are you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, some would use the term woke, if you will, a wokeism that was introduced and caught hold, and as we've seen it in other aspects, and we don't even need to call it that, but some people would assign that name to it. But it's some would say it's Marxism. I don't know what it is, but I don't know that we need to label it as such. But it's just a radical way of thinking that crept into to teaching, and it's not just in journalism. It's in other things as well. But this is the way that it manifested itself in the way that journalism is taught.
So then these students, like, you learned what you learned, these students are learning that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's what they come out and do, not even knowing that they're being taught something very different from what was taught before.
Yeah.
They don't know it's wrong.
To them, it's normal. To them, it's...
They don't know it's wrong. Like, there's not, I was trying to work with someone once to fix a problem, but in his mind, there wasn't a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So he wasn't going to come up with the solution because he didn't see it as a problem, but I saw it as a big problem. So, like, I'm just wondering, and I know I'm going ahead in your book, but you're saying, with the apologies and all that stuff, but they would have to know that what they're doing is not journalism. I mean,
right.
as we used to know it. I mean, who's to say what's right and wrong? But in your mind, it was wrong. That's why you left, right?
Correct. And so, yeah. So I'll give you a quick example. So there was a, and I think I talk about this in the book. There was a bomb that struck a, I think it was a hospital in the Gaza Strip, and the media reported that that came from the Israelis, and it caused massive devastation, killed all these people, etc. Well, as it turned out, that was not true. The information was traced back to a Palestinian or to a Hamas based information source. So you have to, as they say, consider the source. So as it turned out, the rocket was not from the Israelis, and it was one of their own or something like that, and it didn't cause nearly the damage that they purported it to be. So, but the media jumped on it. They jumped on it because they don't like the Israelis.
So they said the Israelis did the bomb, but it was actually Hamas, wasn't it?
I believe it was.
So, yeah. But then we get demonstrations and protests against Israel based on wrong news.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter that later on they put a little bit that corrected it, right? I mean, look at...
Well, yeah, that's the way that corrections, when I was, for 25 years, and I'm sure long, long, long before that, yeah, the correction is never across the top the way that the initial headline is. And that always kind of, made me stop and wonder. Your initial headline could be, as we say, above the fold. So if you fold a newspaper, above the fold, across the top, boom, big headline. But then the correction is little itty bitty correction on page 15 or whatever.
Right. So the headline.
The newspaper doesn't like to admit that it's wrong. I mean, nobody enjoys admitting they're wrong, but sometimes you have to take your lumps.
Right. But look what this wrong. I mean, I don't know if this was the thing that created the whole, the student protests and all that.
I don't know. I mean, it may have been a contributing factor, but if you look at the media by and large, Israel are the bad guy. The Israelis are the bad guys, and Hamas and Gaza Strip, they are, if they're not the good guys, they're at least the victims.
Which is not true. Because they're the ones that attacked, right?
Well, they did. And I mean, and you could go back and you could say, well, these two groups have been fighting for forever. So who knows? Nobody's squeaky clean in all of this.
But
talking about the initial.
Yeah, we're talking October 6th or 7th. Hamas attacked Israel.
Yes. That would be correct.
But Israel was not. Israel was not the aggressor. Hamas was. I'm Jewish and I'm pro-Israel, so I'm just going to say.
Okay.
I just have to say this: Hamas was the bad guys, but somehow, whatever they did, getting this stuff out there, propaganda, people were against Israel, who was the victim.
Mm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Somehow they got contorted. Right. Right. Somehow it got contorted.
Now I've also, I know I shouldn't bring this in, but I've also heard that it's China who also did that with the Ukraine. When Russia attacked the Ukraine, they put the propaganda out for Russia to be the victim here. When they weren't. So just like, Israel, they made Israel look like the bad guys when they're the ones that were attacked, innocent mm-hmm. people being killed. And also with Russia. So that propaganda, I mean, is that the new world that the one with the most money and the most stuff gets to?
Well, it's up to journalists to be able to sift through that and to say, because I have a phrase in the book about the thirst to be first. And so there's such, there's a preoccupation that there's an obsession with being first. And that's always been there, about, we got to break the news. I get that. But if you break the news and you're not accurate, then it kind of doesn't count.
Like with the Trump thing, when you're saying, you know, there were some loud noises, I mean, how...
Talking about the assassination attempt, right?
Yeah, like if you're trying... Okay, you're trying to be first, you hear it, you go... How would you then... So you want to be first, so you got that going on. But how do you then make sure you're right? Like how...
Wait just a little bit, and you have to be a little... You have to exercise a little bit of patience... Because I know it's crazy. I know, and it's crazy for me to say this as a former journalist. But just you've got to check your sources. You need more than one, and you need to just kind of wait a minute and kind of see how it develops. You know, it's like what they say. I think with a car crash in like a NASCAR race, right? With a car crash, you have to kind of wait till things settle. And then you can, it's possible that you can drive through that if you're behind the crash, you know, so you got to kind of wait to see how things develop a little bit and then check your various sources and not just rely on one source, like in that case of it being a Hamas source.
Right.
Like, I mean, you know, like as a reporter, say I received that information. Be like, okay, thank you. Okay, I've got it here, duly noted. I have it here. Now I'm going to start checking some other sources and see how that matches up with what the first source told me.
So, like, what? Let's say that actually happened because I don't understand, you know, like how a source works. Like, you get this Hamas thing. Okay, where is your source? Is your source actually there? Are they feeding you information?
Or it could have been from some type of posting online. It could have been from X, you know, Twitter. It could have been. I'm not sure exactly where it was that they found it, that the media found this.
Right, but let's.
It could have been a press release of some type.
Possibly. And then what? So that's okay. So the source could be a press release. What
and then
else?
They just ran with it. And they just immediately took it as fact and ran with it.
And if let's say it was you and you were checking another source, that was a Hamas source. Where would you find an Israeli source? Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm just asking how it actually works in real life. Like,
sure. No.
Like, where are you?
And I don't, I'm not working, you know, I would find. Maybe call the State Department, call the United States too.
Okay.
Like, find somebody from Israel, find somebody from the United States.
That's your job. That's your job to do that. Right. Okay.
Right.
Like if you were investigating crime.
Well, okay. Here's something I could probably talk about a little bit.
How does it work?
Well, it might start with an affidavit of probable cause. So somebody's been arrested and charged with a crime. So the affidavit is a document that has been written by a police officer and it's been signed by a judge. And so in it, you might have, or you're going to have information about the crime, the alleged crime. And so if the suspect is out, you would attempt to contact them and say, hey, look, I'm planning on doing a story. This says, you know, you were involved in a shooting on such and such a day and time. I want to give you the opportunity to say whatever you want about it, you know, I have some questions for you as well. But, you know, I'm opening it up here for you. I'm giving you this opportunity, if the person is not in prison or in jail at the time. And then you might go and see, usually the victim is named as well, unless they're a juvenile. And unless they are, if it's sexual assault, then we don't print the names of at least not at any of the papers I worked at, never printed names of sexual assault survivors. Although there was one case where we did, because the woman came forward on Facebook and she was out with it. Like she said, look, I am a victim of this. I'm telling my story here on social media. So then I contacted her, and yeah, she consented to an interview and all that. But that's kind of an extreme case.
Yeah.
But you would contact the victim as well and get their side of things. And then if anything in the affidavit was unclear, you'd try to call the investigating officer or their supervisor and get that information from them. So you see how you're constructing a story and looking at all the avenues, all the parties involved.
Right. So you weren't one of those people trying to get it out first. You were actually taking your time.
At the same time, I was doing that. At the same time, I'm thinking, I need to work on this. I need to work this thing and do the best, to the best of my ability, because quite possibly my rivals, are going to be doing the same thing. My competitors are going to be doing that. So there's always that hanging over you, the deadline and the break the news, and that's always hanging over you for sure. Yeah. Wow. It's pressure.
Okay. All right. So we are actually, we're going to take a commercial break right now, and then we'll come back and we'll talk more about your book and what you want to leave people with and all that stuff. Sound good?
Sounds great.
All right. We'll be right back.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. KIKORI.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary Show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real Process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
And thank you, as always, to our sponsor, KikoriApp.com. They are an experiential social-emotional learning platform that you can bring into your schools to help your teachers have children experience, how to be kind, how to be patient, how to work better with people. And it really is an incredible, incredible platform. It's a startup, and if that's something you want to bring into your schools, your businesses, your teams, go to KikoriApp.com and check it out. It's really incredible. Okay. And then we have my books, which I always get to plug because it's my show. There's this book, Real Talk, that you saw in the commercial. And that's for people who you want to speak up, but you just can't. And anyway, there's a process in here. It helped me. I was one of those people that did not. Everything was fine. And I just didn't say anything. And now my life works a lot better since I found my process. This one is Your Bullshit is Your Blessing, How to Stop Fixing Yourself and Start Having Fun. Talks about the two sides of life that I found myself on. One was the really kind of dark side, like PR, we'll say that. The dark side where everything kind of sucked. And then there was another side that was really fun. And so I started finding techniques for spending less time on the suck side and more time on the fun side. So if you find yourself there, definitely check this out. You can find them all on Amazon. And then my very first memoir, The Second Piece of French Toast, tells about how I was on the dark side for many years. And then I went on a journey. I talk about my journey to inspire others in case you also find yourself in that place and to give you hope. So the tagline is, if marriage was my dream, why was I numbing myself? And I certainly found out why and got to the other side. So now we're going to bring back Ted, who's on the dark side himself now, but we're going to go back to the light side.
Here we are.
When he went from light to dark. Okay. So go ahead. So let's talk. I know I keep taking you off topic, but
no, that's all right.
I'm
all right.
Interested and I get to ask the question. So anyway, so we have Saving the Beast. Again, a recovering reporter reflects on America's broken media and how to fix it with Ted Check. We're here with the author. So, all right, I'll let you talk because otherwise I'll take you off.
That's the beauty of a podcast. You know, you can go in whatever direction you want, and it's
right.
I kind of like that. I kind of like just taking whatever path opens up to you. Yeah. But you know, I was just thinking about another example recently. You know, we had the terrorist attack in New Orleans, and some of the media, their headlines were really kind of just tone deaf and just way off the mark, where they were saying, oh, car plows into crowd or no, the car didn't do it. The man did it. The man driving the car did it. The car itself didn't do it. It's not a self-driving car. At least I don't believe that. I mean, apparently they have those things in the works or whatever, but no, the car didn't do it on its own. The man did it. You know, it's just little things like that make you wonder, did they have the intern do it today, or is this just like the new normal, or somebody's asleep at the wheel? Like what's going on here? Why are they doing this sort of thing? And
and in your book you were talking about, you know, defunding the police, and you can't talk about crime, and you have to make it seem nice when, you know, who came up with that crap. Why would you ever want to defund the police? And why would you like, crime is crime, you know, like why are they trying to make it not crime? And then you let all these, oh, they speak.
The idea is that they think that it reflects negatively upon certain segments of the population. Right. But I was told that. So before I left here was one of the big things of why I left as well, was I was told I was to do less stories about kind of just the day to day crime that was occurring, like the armed robberies. But these were I was restricting myself to just felonies, right? Like serious crimes, armed robbery, shootings, things like that. And I was told I was to do less of that because that reflected negatively upon minorities. And I said, you know what? I said, I just go where the crime leads me. I'm not looking at color. I'm looking at what the crime is first, because that was the way I was going through affidavits. And like, you know, I would go through, we have the magisterial level, which is the lowest level of court. So everything has to filter through the magisterial level. So I'd be looking and going through court by court and seeing, okay, what do you have that's heavy? You know, what do you have that's rises to that level that I would report on it. And that's what I would start with. And then I would, eventually I would find out who was the suspect and get the mugshot. That was another thing. They told me they didn't want to use mugshots anymore. So see, to me, it's all part of situational awareness. It's all being, you know, if you're part of the community, then you want to know what's going on around you. You want to know where the crime is occurring, what has happened. It just helps you with surviving as an individual, the more you know.
So you know? Yeah, but these people who are like, oh, you know, it looks bad, it sounds like they're like those, now tell me if I'm drawing the wrong conclusion, they're like those professors who were saying, hey, you know,
like the activists and the
It's all part of the same thing. It's all part of the same movement. You know, the same mutation that has gripped journalism. And this is why, or it's part of why the American people have, as I say, they've taken their time and their money and they've gone elsewhere. When the internet came around, a lot of newspapers thought it was a flash in the pan. They thought it was a fad. Some of them said, "Oh, this might be a tool we can use," but they didn't see it as a cultural phenomenon, as part of the, you know, ushering in the digital revolution.
Oops.
Right. Oops. You know, because let's look at history. When radio came along, people, apparently, from what I understand, people said, "Well, that's the death of the newspaper right there. Radio is going to kill newspapers." It didn't. Right. TV came along. That's the death of the newspaper. Well, no, it didn't. So the internet was looked upon as the same way. It's not going to kill us. But yes, it kind of did. And so newspapers were slow to get on the online, and they didn't all collectively get together and say, we're going to erect a paywall. All of us, we're going to charge. Some charged and some didn't. You know, if they all did at the same time, then if you wanted your newspaper, you'd be forced to pay for it.
Right.
But some of them offered it for free. See? And even now, locally here, like my newspaper charges for a subscription, but you can go to WGAL, which is a TV station, and you can get pretty much all the news that you can get at the newspaper, you can get at WGAL.com for free. Because TV stations make their money off the TV ads, and they can afford to not charge online. So it's a tough business. But the bottom line is that people are leaving the mainstream media because they're fed up with it. That they're just fed up with being told what and how to think. So they're migrating. It's not as though they don't want the news. Like the thirst for the news is always there. And the news doesn't report itself, last I checked, AI. So people have to get their news from somewhere. So they're going to independent sources. I mean, look at Tucker Carlson. Look at the success he's had when he got fired from Fox, and then he brokered a deal with Elon Musk, and now he's got this wildly successful show. Plus, he has his own network that you can subscribe to as well. But independent sources, podcasts, where it's long form. People are getting their news, you know, in a longer format because they want to drink it in. You know, they want to go on a car ride and turn on this thing and be entertained for 2 hours at a stretch or whatever. You know, people are going to podcasts. They're going to X. They're going to TikTok even, believe it or not. The younger crowd, not me, not you probably, but the younger crowd. They're going to TikTok. They're going to Snapchat. Things like that, places like that, and they're getting their news. Yeah, crazy, crazy. But so they're going.
The model changed. The model changed.
They're going elsewhere. Yeah. Right. So you're trying
to bring it back,
right? I think we'd like to believe the mainstream media, at least to some degree. I think there's been a loss of innocence. I don't think we're ever going to get back to Walter Cronkite, where we believe he was America's grandfather and we believed every single word that came out of his mouth. I don't think we're ever going to get back to that point. We'll always be questioning things. And I think that's a good thing. I think it's a good thing to question things. So there's been that loss of innocence. But I think
I don't think people question it. I mean, I know during the election, there's two sides. You got these stations and these stations. And if you talk to the people who watch these, they believe everything they hear. And these people over here, I got my hands up, believe what they hear. I don't think they question it. Very few that I've talked to, you know, it's like, that's not true. You know, if you say something you heard on yours, that's not true. Mm. Well, that's not true. You believe that. And it's like, what happened? Like, it's definitely divisiveness. Somebody is creating divisiveness.
Right. We're very polarized now. That, and that's true. You are correct. like we're very polarized. We now retreat to our own echo chambers. We want to hear repeated back to us what we already believe, because that helps reaffirm what we believe. And that's unfortunate that we're just so partisan. And
right. Split. And that has nothing to do with what you're talking about. Journalism was,
these are the facts. These are the different sources. You decide. It's like you're being told to hate Trump, or you're being told to think Biden's an idiot. You know, do you know what I mean? Like, that's what they present.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's what they, and it may be that that's a survival technique, because the, you know, like Fox News would be like, well, we know we got the conservatives, so we're going to cater to them. And MSNBC is like, well, we know we got the liberals, so we're going to cater to them. And so everybody has at least their core audience, rather than trying to appeal to a broader audience of everybody. So I'd like to see us get back to that, at least to the mainstream media. At least we can believe some of what they say, and that they're, and by that, in order for us to do that, they need to play it down the middle. They need to embrace objectivity, because I have a saying in the book about objectivity is not a dirty word. That's another thing that, you know, about the colleges and universities, is that's what they teach, is that objectivity is a dirty word. Essentially, they call it both sides-ism. They make it an ism, and they say, oh, it's wrong to present both sides. No, it's not wrong to present both sides. That's the whole essence of journalism.
But so, look, I hear you. I agree with you. I don't like what's going on. However, if you have these people who don't think that what they're doing with this activism and advocate and just presenting their side and telling you how to think, if they don't think that there's something to be fixed,
right?
How would it ever change? You know, that's what they're learning in school, that this is okay. Then the problem is with the professors. How do you change it there? How do you?
Well, you have to go above them, and same thing with like newspaper editors and people involved in cable news. So Jeff Bezos, and who owns the Washington Post, in addition to Amazon, and a guy named Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong, who is a billionaire doctor and also owns the LA Times. They both said just before this most recent presidential election, they told their editorial boards, they said, you will not endorse anybody for president. You won't endorse Kamala, even though on both sides they were going to. They were going to at the Washington Post, and they were going to at the LA Times. You won't endorse her, and you're not going to endorse Trump. You're not going to endorse anybody, because guess what? That's not what we're in business for. Now, to me, the reasoning is that there's no more clear-cut way of saying which way you lean than by endorsing a particular candidate of one party or another. Well, that's not what the newspaper's in business for, in my opinion. I always felt weird whenever whatever publication I was working for endorsed a candidate. I'm like, what? We're doing that? No. Why are we telling people what we think? Who are we? So, and that's essentially what Jeff Bezos and Patrick Soon-Shiong told their editorial boards. We're not in the business to do that sort of thing. We're not going to do it. And there was a hue and a cry, and some people just quit out of protest or whatever, but you got to hold fast. If you're going to say something like that, make it the beginning of something. And you know, Jeff Bezos did publish an essay about his reasoning, and that was essentially what he said. He said, we've lost credibility with the American public, and we need, and this is the first step in regaining it.
So that's good.
Right. So it is good. I gave praise to him for that. And I hope it, because my point in the book was, because this happened after I wrote the book, that's the whole thing with Bezos and Soon-Shiong. You know, my point in the book was that mainstream media has to lose enough money. And that's when they hit rock. That's when they've hit rock bottom. That's when when a drug addict hits rock bottom, then they realize, oh, you know what? Guess what? I'm the problem. It wasn't anybody else. It's not this person's fault or that person's fault or this situation. It's me. The only way that a newspaper or a TV or, you know, cable news is going to realize that something needs to change is for them to hit rock bottom. And they look in the mirror and they say, I'm the problem. And the only way for them to do that, the catalyst for that is they've lost enough money. Who knows what that amount is, but they need to.
When did Jeff Bezos buy the Washington Post? Like a while ago, or is this new?
No, he's owned it for a few years now.
Okay.
At least.
Yeah. So that's great.
You know, and it may be the Trump effect. You know, it may be, there's a new sheriff in town and that's what people accused him of. Oh, you're just trying to curry favor with Trump. That's the only reason why. Well, if he was trying to do that, why wouldn't he order his paper to endorse Trump?
Right.
But he didn't. He told them not to endorse anyone.
Right. Well, good. So there's hope.
And then, here's another thing that I just learned about. I think it was a day or two ago. Jeff Zuckerberg, who owns Facebook, he said, we're not going to do fact-checking anymore. And that's another thing that I rail against in the book is fact-checking, because fact-checking should be baked into the process of journalism. You don't need to have other people fact-checking. That should just be in your work,
right?
As a journalist. You know, if somebody says one thing and then you say, oh, but this person said, you know, the direct opposite of that. So here it is. You know, fact-checking just opens up a whole, it's a big mess. But anyway, he said, we're not going to do fact-checking anymore on Facebook. We're going to go more to the community notes version of things, like what X is doing. So community notes it's kind of a form of fact-checking, but it's a whole community thing where people provide context.
But like, what part of Facebook? Is this like on a personal post or like where, you know what I mean?
You know what? I'm not even sure how it manifested because I never had anything nothing of mine was ever fact-checked. But, you see, they do it on YouTube. They'll have.
I had stuff removed. I had.
That might be a product of the fact check. That was probably a product of the fact checking.
They said, you know, I was reporting. These were interviews where the person said it to me, mm-hmm. and I put it in the notes.
Right.
Your age.
You'd be glad they had his journalism.
And then they say, you don't have permission. I'm like, so it made no sense. But anyway.
Right.
So they're going to let they're not going to censor is what you're saying?
That's what it appears. It appears they won't censor. They'll just provide context.
Right.
So, for example, the wildfires in California, there's been a lot of debate as to whether L.A. Mayor Karen Bass, did she chop the budget for the L.A. FD Fire Department or not prior to this happening? People are going back and forth saying, yes, she did. No, she didn't. One guy, said he provided it. He posted something, I think it was from Politico, saying that she did not slash the budget. And then there was a community note under it saying, she kind of did, you know. So like it just provides more context, gives you, it paints the fuller picture.
Right.
Of things.
Well, you know, we're out of time, believe it or not. I can't believe it. We could go on for hours and hours.
Yeah. We were on a roll.
So darn. Okay. So, what would you want to leave the readers with? Like, you know, I know you have a mission. You have a book. What would you want to leave people with? If you got out your way in 5 years, how would it be?
Well, yeah. And in 5 years, I'd like to check back in. I'd like to write another book in 5 years too, and see how things are going. But it appears as though. We may be headed in the right direction. My hope with the book was to just kind of spur a conversation about these things. So we're
it's like you did.
We're
Jeff Bezos and Dr. Patrick. But it's almost like you put it in the universe and they responded, even though it wasn't out yet.
I'd like to say
you did that.
I'd like to hope so. But yeah, I wanted to encourage a conversation about these things, you know, and with the idea that maybe things aren't really the way that they should be right now. And, you know, the pendulum has swung so far one way and we need to kind of bring it back towards the middle a little bit and kind of take stock of what is the essence of true journalism? Mm-hmm. We need to revisit that. And I'm hoping that, through places like this podcast right here, you know, that hopefully I can reach more people in that regard. And, you know, it looks like there is some progress that's being made on some levels. I'd like to, you know, like as far as, you know, what we just talked about with Jeff Bezos and the LA Times, I'd like to focus more on the hopefully there's a change that starts at the colleges and universities, because that's where we need to get people as they are beginning to learn how to become journalists, because then they're going to, as we talked about, you know, that they're going to become, they're the journalists of the future. So we need to influence them.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I wish we had more time, but thank you for bringing this very important message out to people in such a, you know, deliberate way. He's got so many footnotes. He definitely fact-checked and cites his sources. So
what did I try to?
Yeah. Just thank you so much for your work.
Thank you, Hillary.
Yeah. Really appreciate grateful. It. Thank you. All right. Bye, everyone.
Take care.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.